So this is a joint work with Sandeep Juneja, who is well known in simulation circles. And we were both on sabbatical at a business school, the Indian School of Business in Hyderabad in India. And I took advantage of his expertise on a problem that I was interested in, namely how to efficiently handle portfolio value at risk or other risk management exercises when you have a nested simulation issue that I'll describe, I'll formalize in a moment, but it's something that I'm going to argue arises almost ubiquitously, I think, in derivatives portfolios. So this slide is for a much more general audience. I'll just say here that we're going to be working with some very general derivatives portfolio. We began with an interest in complicated credit derivatives, but this applies generically, and that's how I'll talk about it, to any sort of derivatives. And I think I can take it for granted that you'll agree that in many cases, if you really had total freedom to do whatever you want, you would use a model that would require some simulation to price. And there are going to be some derivatives where you pretty much can't avoid simulation, you know, as much as you try. I mean, people like Leaf continuously reduce that set of things where you absolutely need simulation, but nonetheless, there are many. And we all know the trade-offs to doing that. Simulations are much more slow and have associated, Monte Carlo sort of noise. Now, in risk management, which is the focus today, we have a whole new wrinkle. Here we're talking about really risk measurement of a portfolio at some fixed horizon. And I'm mainly, for the sake of simplicity and working with notation, going to talk about estimating large loss exceedance probabilities. So you have some amount of loss of, let's say, $2 billion, and you want to know the probability that the loss in your portfolio will exceed that number. But we could also talk about quantiles of a loss distribution or expected shortfall or any other measure that you have in mind. Now here, if prices are going to be generated by a simulation algorithm, then to do value at risk or exceedance probabilities, we have a nested problem. So you have what we're call the outer loop. And in the outer loop, what you're doing is you're drawing paths for the underlying state prices or state variables, anyway, from today up to the model horizon, right? And you're collecting your implied cash flows along the way. Now you're at the horizon, and now you've got to get new prices on everything that's sitting in your portfolio. And if you have to do those by a simulation, then that inner step simulation is tucked within the outer step simulation, and this gives rise to the nested structure. And our understanding is that in practice, people perceive this as computationally infeasible, or at least extremely burdensome, because you have to multiply the number of inner step trials by the number of outer step trials. That gets very large. And practitioners in the models that I've seen certainly have been very willing to use extremely rough pricing tools, much rougher than what they would do on a trading floor, at the horizon in order to avoid a nested simulation. And the main point of the paper is to show that the conventional view is wrong, that the interstep simulation really does not make the whole problem that much more burdensome. So I'll have about a slide and a half of just enough notation so that we can attach some vocabulary to things. So the present time will be normalized to zero. Model horizon is fixed at H. Could be today, a day, 2 weeks, a year, whatever. XT is going to be our vector of state variables that will govern the underlying prices that are referenced by the derivatives. XC is the filtration. It's the information that's generated in the outer step between time zero and the model horizon. Whatever we generate in that outer step is recorded in XI. The portfolio will have K plus one positions. And the price of position little k at the horizon will depend on the outer step realization, xi, as well as, of course, the contractual terms of the instrument. Position zero is going to be the subportfolio of instruments for which you have perfectly adequate analytical prices. And positions 1 through K are the ones that are of interest here, where you need an interstep simulation. Now, loss, I think it should be clear now, is going to be defined on a mark-to-market basis, right? We're repricing. It's going to be the current value of the position, less the discounted horizon value, adjusting for the present discounted value of any interim cash flows. So W sub K is going to be the loss in position K, and loss for the portfolio is just the sum of the W's. So these are all expressed in currency units, which can be positive or negative. Conditional on C, W sub K is, of course, non-stochastic, right? The problem is that we don't observe it, because we don't have an analytical formula. Rather, we're going to use Monte Carlo in the interstep to obtain a noisy estimate W tilde sub K of, you know, a conditional on Xi, and thereby also a noisy Y tilde. So the simulation framework, there are going to be two things to pay attention to here. Capital L, dimension of the outer step, and capital N, the dimension of the inner step. But just to make things concrete, L will be the number of outer step trials, and within each trial, we're going to draw a single path for the state prices under the physical measure. This is, for better or worse, what we do in risk measurement. We're drawing from today to the horizon under the physical measure. We're getting a physical distribution of loss. Xi is the relevant information. And now we're going to revalue, reprice at the horizon. We're going to accrue the interim cash flows forward to H. We're going to get the closed form price at H for instrument zero, and for the remaining instruments, simulate with N interstep trials to get those new prices. And of course, these are under the risk neutral measure. So of course, we take this discount back to time zero, subtract from the current value, and we have our position losses, and we sum. Okay, so Y tilde is going to be our noisy measure of portfolio loss in the outer step represented by Xi. Just a minor digression on the dependence structure. Up to the horizon, we have to do everything jointly, right? We're interested in the portfolio behavior. So we need to capture the full dependence structure in the portfolio, which means that if the state price vector is of high dimension, we're simulating under pretty high dimension of state prices. The interstep simulations, though, are run independently across position. And that's simply because the value of position K at the horizon is just a conditional expectation of its own subsequent cash flows, right? And this has two consequences. One, just from a computational perspective, it's a convenient feature that it reduces the memory footprint in the interstep. You generally have a much smaller vector of state prices that you need to simulate for a given instrument, maybe just one or two. More importantly, the independent intersteps imply that the pricing errors that we're going to generate in those interstep simulations are independent across positions and are going to therefore tend to diversify away at the portfolio level. So our contribution, the key insight, I guess, is that the mean zero pricing errors are going to have pretty minimal effect on the estimation. And we're going to be able to set N, the dimension of the interstep simulation, pretty small. For any finite N, our estimators of exceedance probabilities and value at risk and expected shortfall are going to be biased. For expected shortfall, provably biased upwards. For the other, they will be biased upwards except in pathological cases. More importantly, we can obtain bias, we can characterize the bias invariance of these estimators, the bias being the harder part. And what that lets us do is say, well, let's say we had a fixed computational budget. We want to choose L and N to minimize the mean square error of the estimator. Okay, we can set up that optimization problem, and we can solve it asymptotically for a large budget. Next, we can talk about large portfolio asymptotics, since Bank of America and other large banks have loads and loads of positions. We're going to get some results that are, when you step back away from it, are completely obvious and intuitive, but which at first may not seem intuitive for many practitioners. And then I hope to get to a discussion of jackknife methods that we can use for bias reduction. Bias is going to be an important problem throughout this. And finally, a dynamic allocation scheme that we came up with, which is both very, very simple to do and really increases efficiency. So as I said, we're going to just talk here about estimating the probability of very large losses. Everything that I'm going to talk about today has parallel and, in fact, almost identical results for value at risk and for expected shortfall. But as I said, the notation just gets messier. So we want an efficient estimate of alpha, which is the probability that Y will exceed some U, the unconditional probability. So not conditioning on C. And we're going to do this via simulation for a given U, and the U is typically large. We care about losing a lot of money. I guess I'm repeating myself here, if the analytical pricing formula were available, YXC would be observable. And in this case, what would we do? We would generate IID samples of XC1, XC2, XCL, feed them through the Y function, and take the average of these indicators to get the empirical CDF, or the 1 minus the CDF, as our estimator of alpha. But of course, that's not what we can do. We're estimating Y via the interstep simulation. And we're going to let zeta sub ki be the zero mean pricing error associated with the ith interstep trial for position k in the outer step represented by C. Capital Z sub I is just taking that up to the portfolio level. Again, zero mean. And the average across our n trials of the interstep is going to be z bar sub n. So now what we can do is we can write y tilde, our surrogate for y, as the true y plus this z bar sub n. Okay? And by the law of large numbers, under some pretty minimal regularity conditions, we have z bar sub n goes to zero almost surely as n goes to infinity. As you'd expect, pricing error vanishes as n grows large. So let's talk now about the mean square error in our estimate alpha hat. Alpha hat's a, well, I have a little ln that I carry through, but this is going to be the empirical CDF, or 1 minus the CDF, of the y tildes. Now we're going to let alpha sub n be the probability, the true probability, that y tilde, not y, but y tilde is greater than u. And that is going to be the expectation of alpha hat and is generally not going to be equal to alpha. In other words, there will be a bias. As usual, we decompose the mean square error into a squared bias over here and a variance. The variance, of course, these alpha hat is binomial, so the variance term is very simple. It's just alpha n 1 minus alpha n over L, right? It's the bias that's a little more interesting. And a key result in the paper, which I don't want to go through for both because it's tedious and because it's not entirely new, is that alpha n can be, you could take a Taylor series approximation where Taylor series of for alpha n in orders of 1 over square root of n. The first term you can show drops out so that you have alpha n being equal to the true alpha plus a term proportional to 1 over n, and we can characterize that term analytically. It depends on the loss the density of the loss, y, and the conditional expectation of its variance. Now, turns out this result appeared, we just, of course, 2 weeks before submitting the paper to a journal, discovered that this was worked out by a PhD student, Peter Glynn at Stanford, back in 98, never published. Independently, it was worked out by a combination of people in the context of looking at the sensitivity of value at risk to portfolio allocation, mainly based on work by Guriro and his co-authors. They got this type of expansion. And very similar approximations. In fact, the original work was done for value at risk. Apply there. Just one thing to comment on here. Y tilde is a mean preserving spread of Y. Okay? And that's why, that is what creates the result that that the bias will be upwards, assuming we're in the tail, the bias will be upwards for expected shortfall, and will be upwards for U and for large enough U and in value at risk, large enough sort of tail quantiles, except in the pathological case where the Y tilde distribution and the Y distribution have an infinite number of crossings, which I think would be hard to construct. All right. Now, to demonstrate what we're doing, I'm going to rely on a very, very simple example, parametric example, where everything is Gaussian. Obviously, you would not use simulation in this case. Doesn't correspond to any, you know, real-world derivative portfolio of interest. But nonetheless, what it allows us to do is to look at the exact solutions for bias, variance, thus mean square error, and compare our approximations, look at the performance of our approximations against exact solutions. All right. So we have a homogeneous portfolio of k positions. And X, which is just standard normally distributed, will be our single market risk factor. The loss on position X, the W's, are going to be just X plus idiosyncratic noise. And we're going to scale by 1 over K to put into currency units so that when we let K, the number of positions, grow large, that the limiting distribution is something interesting. Okay. In fact, the portfolio loss distribution will become standard normal as k goes to infinity. The loss distribution, the true loss distribution, is normal with variance 1 plus nu k, nu squared over k, where nu is this noise in the individual losses. And now we're going to assume that the individual pricing errors, the zetas, are also normal. So the portfolio pricing error has this variance sigma squared equal to eta squared over k for each intercept trial. In general, in the formulas that we saw before, sigma squared is going to be a function of xi. It's going to vary across the outer step trials. But in this simple example, it's just a constant. And finally, what this boils down to is that y tilde is going to be normally distributed as well, but it's going to have this sigma squared over n in the variance. And just bear in mind, sigma squared is also proportional to 1 over k. So the densities of the loss distribution, this shouldn't shock anyone, these are just Gaussian, right? So the point is to just show here the mean preserving spread nature of things. So with n equals infinity, we have the true distribution, which is the black line, and for finite and smaller and smaller and smaller n, we just have more stuff going on. We just widen the distributions. Nothing shocking. Now, the exact bias is easy to write because we know the true distributions. These capital phi are normal CDFs. When we apply the expansion in the proposition that we wrote, we're going to get that the bias is theta over n, where theta has this form. It depends on the normal PDF, the normal density. And this is what it looks like. So I have 1 over n on the x-axis, right? And the approximation then is going to be linear in 1 over n. And what we see here, I want to draw sort of your attention to two things. First, the u that I chose is corresponds to a true alpha of 1%. So for fairly small n, the bias is going to be very large. The bias is going to be of the same order of magnitude as what we're trying to estimate. Right? So that's a non-trivial bias. However, it's very well approximated. By our proposition, I mean, even at n equals 2, I mean, that's about a 17% relative error. Down here, I forget what it is, but it's obviously very small, maybe 2 or 3%. So now we can allocate our workload, right? So the total computational effort is the number of outer step trials times the cost per inner step trial, and that's a fixed cost, gamma zero, plus a per inner step trial cost of gamma one, where these are sort of average costs. So we're going to fix an overall computational budget gamma, set it equal to that cost, and minimize the mean square error conditional on that budget. And when you let gamma grow large, what you get is this result, that the optimal n grows in proportion to gamma to the one-third. The optimal L, therefore, in proportion to gamma to the two-thirds. So in other words, the optimal L, the optimal number of outer step trials, is growing with the square of the optimal number of inner step trials. Right? And you know, sadly enough, Lee beat us to this result, too. For value at risk and expected shortfall, you get something of almost the same form and most importantly, the same growth rates. Back to our Gaussian example, what I've done is I'm approximating the budget here is just n times L, or proportional to n times L, which it will be for large n. And these are just three different budgets, and I'm holding n times L fixed, letting n vary on this axis, adjusting L accordingly, and looking at the root mean square error of our estimator. And the thing to note is that the optimal n's here are generally very small numbers. They grow with the budget, but they grow slowly, as you would expect from that. Now again, we can compare the exact optimal n, we can solve for that in this model, against the asymptotic version. And this is on a log-log scale. Here's your budget, here's optimal n, and you can see we're doing very well with our approximation again. I should point out that the optimal n depends on the exceedance threshold you've chosen, the level u, and not in a simple way. This is, certainly not monotonic. This corresponds to a large budget. Here we have exact and approximate, the approximate in the dashed line, and we have a great fit here. This is the u corresponding to a 1% alpha, 0.1%, and here one basis point, and the fit is great throughout. When we move to a smaller budget, We've got even more non-monotonicity in, if that's a meaningful statement, in the exact relationship, and the approximation starts to break down in the tail, as you might actually expect. Large portfolio asymptotics. So now what we're going to do is consider an infinite sequence of exchangeable positions. So these positions are correlated with one another, but in a uniform way. And we will let y bar be the average loss per position on a portfolio of the first k positions, right? And what we're going to do is, as k grows, we're going to have to let the budget grow, right? Or ultimately, we can't even do one inner step trial per outer step trial if we don't let the budget grow. In fact, you have to let the budget grow at k to the beta, where beta is at least 1. 1 is generally going to be enough, but it may not always be enough. And what we're able to show, basically, is that, assuming that beta is not too large, which is, I think, reasonable, then as k goes to infinity, as the number of positions goes to infinity, n star goes to 1. 1 interstep trial in each pricing algorithm. Now, I just want to step back from this a little bit. This is kind of obvious, right? Certainly once you've seen it, there's nothing here that's not obvious. But so far as I can tell, at least in the practitioner world, this is not how they think about it, perhaps because they're thinking about getting a price that's reasonably useful in a trading situation, where you have to be correct down to basis points. Okay? And in that situation, you may need many, many, many trials. You never simulate something once to get a price, right? You never even do it 10 times to get a price. That's crazy. But in this context, you actually can. And that's partly because we're going to have a large portfolio and those errors will diversify away, but it's also partly because we can adjust for the associated, we can characterize the associated bias and trade it off against the variance. So back to our Gaussian example, what I'm going to do is I'm going to start with a baseline portfolio of 100 positions. And here we're looking at for a given fixed budget. Here's the root mean square error. It bottoms out at about n equals 24. And now we're going to triple the number of positions, but also triple the budget. All right? And what you see is that the optimal n has collapsed back to about 6 or 5, something like that. Okay? Now, as I said, bias is a significant concern here, and it's what we're trading off against the variance. And you might think, well, can we estimate the bias? Can we somehow get rid of it? And the answer is yes. And doing it with a jackknife estimator is the classic way of doing it. It comes with a little bit of a trade-off, but I think a good one. So I'm just going to describe the simplest version of the jackknife. Think about your intercept sample. You're going to do it n times, right? And what you're going to do is you're going to divide that into two subsamples of n over 2 each, disjoint subsamples. Let alpha hat sub j be the estimator of alpha based on only using subsample j. Okay. Now, the bias in this subsample-based estimator will be equal to our theta from before over n over 2 instead of n, right? Because it's based on n over 2 interstep trials plus terms of smaller magnitude. And we're going to take advantage of that. The jackknife estimator A is defined as twice the uncorrected estimator minus the mean of the jackknife, the subsample estimators. Sorry, these are the subsample estimators. Here's their mean, twice the original one, and that's our jackknife estimator. Okay? Notice that it needs no additional work. All we're doing is, as we go through our N intercept trials, just keeping track of how we do up to N over 2. Okay? And we can generalize this into having I overlapping subsamples. This is often done in jackknife estimation, but it's going to, well, I'll get to that in a moment. The bias. So what the jackknife does is it gets rid of the first order term in the bias, right? Because the bias was theta over n in the uncorrected, was theta over n over 2 in the jackknife,
in the
subsample estimators. So the jackknife estimator, then you eliminate, this term drops out, and you just have the smaller order of magnitude terms that are left. The variance of A is going to depend on the covariances among the original uncorrected estimator and the subsample estimators. It's going to be tedious but tractable. The optimal choice of N star and L star now is going to change. And that's because bias has been reduced. Bias is now a smaller consideration. And in fact, variance in general, probably shouldn't have written this because you can't, I haven't been able to work out a proof for it for the general case, but what you're going to observe is that the variance will go up. This is typical in jackknife estimation. You're trading off bias and variance. And what you're going to find is now N star grows even more slowly, gamma to the 1/4 instead of gamma to the 1/3. Back to our Gaussian example. Bias and variance are going to have analytical expressions in this example, which will involve bivariate normal CDFs. If we fix N at, let's say, 8, and then the other parameters that I've been using in the examples, here's what we observe. For the uncorrected estimator, the bias was 38 basis points. For the jackknife, the bias is generally negative, and it's an order of magnitude smaller. The standard deviation of the estimator is going to go up, but modestly so. If we use more complicated jackknife estimators where now we take more sections, more subsamples, and they become overlapping, the bias reduction is a bit more effective, but the variance, the standard deviation goes up quite a bit. That's one of the reasons I didn't present it here, and it's in our paper. Now let's take a fixed budget and choose our optimal N star. In the uncorrected estimator, N star is about 23, and we have a bias of 13 basis points and root mean square error of 24 basis points. For the jackknife, N star drops to 6, quite dramatically. The bias in absolute terms is half of what it was, and the root mean square error has fallen. So a worthwhile thing to do. The last thing I want to talk about is a very simple, and so far as, you know, it seems to us, very generally applicable dynamic allocation scheme that you can use in this situation. So the idea is this. For a given outer step trial C, we're going to make a preliminary estimate of y based on a very small number, n1, maybe as small as n1 equals 1, of intercept trials. And if we find that the resulting y tilde for C is nowhere near the cutoff u, then with reasonable confidence we can say that this indicator of y tilde greater than u, whether it's 0 or 1, is going to be a pretty good estimate of the true. Even though y tilde itself could be still a very noisy estimator for y. So we may as well stop. Just stop there and move on. Okay? So to implement this intuition, what we're going to do is fix an n1 and n2 in a bandwidth, epsilon, and we'll get our preliminary y tilde based on n1 trials. And if y tilde is greater than u minus the bandwidth, it's close enough to u, we can generate another N2 intercept trials and set our dynamic allocation y to the full, you know, to the y based on the full N1 plus N2 samples. Otherwise, we just stop and set the dynamic allocation y to just the small sample y. And accordingly, our estimator is, you know, the usual one. Now, the average effort, let's say we fix N1 and N2 to sum to the capital N that we would have used in the standard estimator, the static, what I can call here the static allocation estimator. And here it's, of course, trivial to see that the average effort has gone down because we're doing N2 not very often. Right? Now, the bias, we're going to be able to write as the bias of the static estimator minus a joint probability. And therefore, it's going to be less than the bias of the static estimator. Now, in other words, we've added a negative increment to the bias relative to the static estimator. As we discussed before, in a typical application, that bias in the static estimator is positive. So what that shows, in that case, we can always choose an epsilon that will reduce the absolute bias relative to the static estimator. Okay? In other words, like for free, you're reducing the bias, the variance isn't changing, and, well, not by, you know, very tiny amounts, and generally in your favor. And so you're reducing mean square error and you're reducing workload, which is kind of a nice thing, and it's obviously very easy to implement. Even when we, for some reason, cannot find the bias in the static estimator, we can show that you can at least bound the increase in bias relative to the static scheme, and in general, that it's going to be very small, smaller order of magnitude. In the Gaussian example, again, the bias is going to turn out to involve a bivariate normal CDF, but, you know, analytical expressions, our usual baseline parameters. The static scheme with n equals 32, for example, has a bias of 9 basis points. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to try a dynamic allocation scheme with our preliminary estimator based on one trial and our secondary, our continuation at, you know, set of trials will be 31 to sum up to 32. Now, oh, and we're going to set the bandwidth equal to the standard deviation of y. Now what we find is that n bar, the average workload per intercept trial, is going to fall from 32 to about 6. The bias is going to fall from 9 basis points to negative 0.4 basis points. So we've reduced effort by 80%, and we've absolute bias has been reduced by 95%, which, you know, in the simulation world is nice. You know. So conclusion, the takeaways. First, large errors in pricing individual positions, grotesque errors in pricing individual positions, you know, unimaginably large errors, can be tolerated as long as they can be diversified away or corrected for with bias correction. The intercept is going to give errors that are zero mean and independent, so it's ideal for this, right? It's ideal for the portfolio setting. And in practice, we suspect that for many large banks, N star will be of order one. And that means that current practice in the value at risk world is misguided, right? The use of shortcut pricing methods, which themselves can be computationally non-trivial, is going to introduce model misspecification. The errors are hard to bound. I mean, whenever you have a misspecified model, in general, You don't know, you know you have a bias now, but you don't know which way. And they don't diversify away at the portfolio level because you're using the same models sort of throughout your portfolio. So when you use lousy models just to get a rough cut in value at risk, you're introducing noise, but you're introducing noise of an unknown form, essentially. So what we're suggesting is instead use the best models that you've got, run very few trials in the interstep, and if you're going to have some bias and noise in there, at least it's a known form and can be characterized very well asymptotically. And next, this dynamic allocation scheme, one of the nice things about it is, relative, the usual sort of variance reduction methods can be very difficult to work with in high-dimensional settings, in settings where you have both long and short exposures. So, for example, with important sampling, if you only had long exposures, you would kind of know where the bad corner of the state space is, right? And you could sort of shift in that direction. But where you have a lot of hedging going on, you don't know where the bad holes necessarily are in this high-dimensional portfolio that you have, which means that important sampling can actually make things worse. It can be very hard to work with in that setting. And here, it doesn't make things worse at all. I mean, it's invariant to that. And finally, the techniques that we're talking about here have application to pricing and to credit rating. To pricing, things like, let's say you want to write a call option on a derivative that you need to price by simulation, that kind of thing. You have a nested simulation structure, you can use some of these techniques. So that's left for the future. Thank you. I'm sorry, what?
An example of a shortcut pricing model and a best pricing model.
So, especially given the presence of my predecessor up here, I would be very reluctant to do it. I would defer to people here. In my interaction with practitioners, I'm not one. They tell me that, some things you do by simulation, some things, you do analytically. Very often you are at least your analytical prices, you are checking against models where you simulate. I don't know if this is universal practice. I'll leave that to others to comment on. I mean, if you have shortcuts that you're completely happy with and you really believe in, then, God bless and go ahead, right? This is what the utility of what we're talking about really depends on whether there are models that you would like to run, but don't just because they involve simulation.
A quick comment I could make is that sometimes pricing models that are used in an individual market may be extremely complicated in the sense that you could have a US dollar interest rate model with 10 factors, stochastic volatility and jumps and all that. If you try to marry that with everything else, complicated FX models, complicated commodities models, complicated currency models, complicated euro, you get so many state variables that you need to move around that people in risk would not be able to understand it. Instead, they say, the market's out. We cannot possibly do all these things that you do in the individual market. And FX to us is pretty much like a Black-Scholes thing. It doesn't have the jumps and the stochastic volatility and so forth. And hence, you cannot use the true pricing model. It's just too complicated.
So in that case, what you're saying there is that it's not the repricing step. It's that you cannot, it's actually the outer step is too complicated if you have a model of everything.
Yeah, the filtrations, in a sense, used by risk management are much simpler than used in the true pricing model, where you need extreme precision matching.
You know, that may be, but I'm not sure that there's a fundamental reason why that has to remain so, right?
no fundamental reason, but some practical reason.
Yeah, I mean, you would clearly, you know, to have a model of everything, it would have to be modular in the sense that you would want to characterize the co-movement between, let's say, those 10 factors and factors that are out in the commodity world, and so you'd want to have a fairly simple dependence structure for them, right? But there's no reason why you couldn't sort of attach them to some sort of global factors and take advantage of the fact that the programming is already done at the individual desk and do it in some kind of tree-like...
In principle, yeah.
But if I can add, there are some very simple problems you have the stacking structures, right? Pricing of revealing options, which you might approximate, for example, by exposure with just simple model, or the most typical one that I think is the original motivation had, which is tracking of more impact security. So performing more impact security for CDOs is very complicated structures where I would worry less than whether we have even a decent simple model to approach the thing. So what do people do? They might grab all the more impact security and think about bond.
Yeah.
And they put an option of spread maybe, but once they go into the grid system, they go with a way to use this model, they don't adapt to that. That would be a big complication.
We've learned that's bad.
We've learned that's exactly bad and we're going to learn that in a while.
So that's right.
And the portfolio, that's a very, very good example of the
I have one further comment that is, in general, when we try to rely, I think most practitioners tend to rely on approximation primarily, or at least more, they rely on them more when they do things like economic capital, which is not you have to simulate a total portfolio, not just through a week ahead, but you have to do an entire exposure path, potentially for 30 years, each quarter, each month, you have to spawn off simulation. That just gets at some point out of control. Even just doing one of these simulations could get complicated. And then you have deal-specific nettings making the problem super non-linear. So some of the, I'm pretty sure that some of the smooth approximations, they were starting up.